Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Joshua Kurtlancic, who is a fellow for Southeast Asia at the Council on Foreign Relations, who has been a columnist for Time magazine, a special correspondent for The New Republic, a senior correspondent for The American Prospect, and a contributing writer for Mother Jones. His books include Charm Offensive, How China's Soft Power is Threatening the World, and Democracy in Retreat, The Revolt of the Middle Class and the Worldwide Decline of Representative Government. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joshua Kurtlancic.
Thanks for having me.
And the president has just signed the Enhanced Defense Cooperation Agreement with the Philippines. That's taken 10 years to generate this pact, although the U.S., of course, had up until 1992 had one of its biggest bases in the world in the Philippines. There is, of course, some local resentment, but most of the reaction to it is coming against it, is coming from China. Quite vociferous. The Chinese leadership via their official news outlet are describing the Philippines as the troublemaker of the South China Sea and warning the U.S. that given that the Philippines is in a bitter territorial row with China, the move is particularly disturbing as it may embolden Manila in dealing with Beijing. So what's happening to this so-called pivot to Asia? Is it less of a pivot to Asia than a containment of China? At least that's how the Chinese see it.
Well, first of all, it's hardly surprising that the agreement provoked a reaction in China. I think the Philippines and the U.S. accepted that. What's important to look at is not what the Chinese say immediately after, but their actual reaction. In terms of their military actions and how they act in the South China Sea. I think the pivot is about a lot more than the Philippines. It involves basically all of the Pacific Rim. And although the president is never going to say this, there, some aspect of it is, I wouldn't say containment, but is obviously a response to or a proactive measure to support allies in the region against China, potentially. Although he's, of course, never going to say that. But in the specific case of the Philippines, there is an element of that in which it's part of the U.S.'s pivot, but there's also a substantial element in which the Philippines has been looking for this because of their own specific concerns about South China Sea.
Well, the Chinese claim 90% of the South China Sea, and I take it that there has already been something of a standoff between the Philippines and China over what's called the Scarborough Shoals, where a vessel was grounded and it's been occupied by Philippine Navy personnel, and China in turn have blockaded those aboard that grounded ship.
Right. So just to be clear, it's not a grounded ship like there was a ship battle. They actually grounded the ship essentially to create a reef. There's a standoff there. The Chinese have also had multiple standoffs and potentially dangerous incidents with Vietnam in the last few years over the South China Sea. And there's also increasing concern in Malaysia and Indonesia over Chinese action in the South China Sea, although Malaysia and Indonesia tend to be much more restrained in their own response and have better relations with China. So it's a difficult situation. I mean, I think what happened in the Philippines was they had a basically incredibly outdated and non-existent Navy and Marines. They've become more worried about their interactions in the South China Sea with China, and they are realizing that they desperately need some reassurance, support, and assistance from the U.S., and they have been pushing the U.S. to provide all of that basically since Obama took office.
So you've described this then more as a Philippine initiative than an American need for a base in Southeast Asia, having had its biggest base in the Pacific already in the Philippines.
Right. Well, there was two bases actually in the Philippines, and they were pushed out because of a whole variety of things, including reasonable Philippine desires to not have forces subject to extraterritorial agreements on their own territory. It's actually kind of interesting now. There have been protests, but because of the great concern over the South China Sea, you actually have a lot of left-wing legislators in the Philippines who 20 years ago would have been among the people who would have definitely wanted the U.S. out, who have been pretty vociferous about the South China Sea. So it doesn't necessarily fall into the usual left-right in the Philippines. So I'm not saying that the pivot is a Philippine-generated initiative or that the administration isn't happy that there's a desire in a number of countries in Southeast Asia for basing rights, just that I don't think that the extent of the assistance and to the Philippines is really what was initially envisioned in the pivot. And actually, the Philippines has wanted the administration to do more, specifically to commit by saying at a summit or at another event, this is exactly what we would do, we the U.S., if China did this in the South China Sea. And so far, the U.S. has refused to do that and has just been kind of supportive but vague. Hillary Clinton said that South China Sea was a national interest. Several U.S. military commanders have said that if there was a greater confrontation, the U.S. would do something to help the Philippines. But actually, the Philippines would like more from the U.S.
Well, I suppose in terms of branding and labeling, both the pivot to Asia, which I understand the White House is trying to change that name. Certainly the reset with Russia has gone nowhere. So in terms of these two brandings, it would seem that the White House is sort of in retreat about them. But what is there? Do they have a new policy or they just have a new name?
Well, I think that obviously the reset with Russia was both a branding failure and just a failure, right?
Right.
You could have a bad brand, but your product could still be good, or you could have a vice versa. The pivot, which they now call a variety of things, including mostly the rebalance to Asia, I think it's been decently successful. It's supposed to be a military, diplomatic, and economic shift of U.S. priorities to the Pacific Rim. So the military part has been mostly successful in that the U.S. has gotten a lot more cooperation from the Philippines, Australia, Singapore, and a lot of other countries in the region. And it hasn't provoked the kind of anti-Americanism you refer to in the Philippines or other places from 20 years ago. The problem has been mostly that the Obama administration said that it was going to be everything, not just a military shift. And the other parts really haven't taken shape. And since it's been mostly a military shift, it's more likely to antagonize China because that has been the focus of basically all of the efforts. If it was a more comprehensive thing and the other parts had succeeded, it actually possibly would antagonize China less.
So in terms of being drawn into a conflict, what you were saying earlier, Joshua Kurlansik, is that the Philippines want more of an assurance that the U.S. will defend them if China pushes too hard. The U.S. already has that agreement with Japan, and Japan and China are in a bitter row over what's often referred to as a pile of rocks. And their warships are starting to sort of, you know, play chicken with each other. And Japan has already garrisoning a nearby island to the one that's in dispute, the so-called Diu Islands. So that surely is something to be concerned about, isn't it? I mean, two superpowers on a collision course over some, you know, pile of rocks or a pile of coral, that's no way to run the world, is it?
Well, I think that the level of concern, not that the U.S. isn't concerned about the Philippines, but the level of concern about China, Japan, and the U.S. being drawn in is much, much higher. And that's for a lot of reasons, including that Japan itself, even though in theory does not have a military force, the self-defense, the quote-unquote self-defense forces of Japan are significant military. So, that's a major concern. That's probably, I would say, right up there with Ukraine and Pakistan and North Korea as the biggest concerns in the world. The Philippines wants, the U.S. has a treaty with the Philippines where the Philippines wants, like you said, basically the U.S. to offer the specific, discrete assurances of exactly what the U.S. would do if China didn't invade the Philippines, in which case the U.S. would be forced by a treaty to respond, but if China did X, Y, Z in the South China Sea. And because our relationship with the Philippines is not the same relationship as with Japan, and because we don't have the confidence in the Philippines military that we have in Japan, the Obama administration is not going to offer them those specific assurances the way they have done it with Japan.
But haven't there been some fairly inflammatory statements from the I don't know whether it's the Philippine president, Aquino, or other high officials referring to China, making analogies with Imperial Japan in the late 30s and Nazi Germany?
I don't know about Imperial Japan, but yeah, definitely President Aquino, the president of the Philippines, has used the idea that China is like Nazi Germany in 1938. He used that in an interview with New York Times, and I'm not sure if there was other reporters who also were at that interview at the Presidential Palace. So it's a cycle, you know. I mean, and like in the U.S. or any other country, what happens is, you know, you can get caught in that cycle, and so he doesn't want to look weak, and so then China doesn't want to look weak. So yeah, he has. You know, I think that the problem, but on the other hand, the Philippines has shown a willingness to take the case to international arbitration. They just submitted their case to international arbitration of, you know, who gets what. How do you respond? How do you divvy up different claims? And they said we're willing to abide by the international arbitrator's ruling. And China said we're not listening. We're not going to the arbitration. Forget that. So. Yeah, I mean, I think President Aquino has said some things, but I think he's also probably more moderated.
So, just in closing, Joshua Kilancic, what can the White House do to assuage China? Because the Chinese are pretty adamant that this pivot, or whatever they want to rebrand it as, is aimed at containing them. The Secretary of Defense got an earful from his Chinese counterpart when he was over there along those lines. So assuming that the U.S. considers that they have a problem with China, what can they do, do you think? Or should they do?
Well, yeah, right. Those are two different questions. I mean, I don't think that the problem is responding, like I said, responding to what China says in the media, in their media. The president and everyone else knows that the standard you have to use is to judge by actions. So I think that what they are going to probably continue to try to do is to boost the level of interaction so that even if Secretary of Defense gets an earful, they have direct contact with top leaders in the PLA and other top leaders so that if there is a real problem, they can call them up. In the past, there's been a problem, which when there was major U.S.-China incidents, like you may remember the spy plane incident in 2001, and Colin Powell and President Bush couldn't reach anyone to talk to them. And that's a big, obviously, that's a big problem. Whether they're actually going to, you know, be able to calm down China's concerns, I don't know if that's even possible. I'm not even sure that the administration really wants to do that. I think the policy is based on a shift of assets, and that policy is probably going to continue. And what they're going to try to do is to make sure that there's some balance kept between protecting the allies in the region and not triggering a crisis. But yeah, I don't see that they're going to take steps other than just what I just said to specifically assuage China, because if they do that, there's going to be a lot of response in the United States, and I don't think that's what President Obama wants.
Well, just in closing, though, it does seem that the whole idea of a pivot, or whatever the new term is, towards Asia, away from being embroiled in the Middle East and in the old Cold War lines, that's all sort of gone up in smoke, to the extent to which now we're getting drawn back into confrontation with Russia, and the Middle East has not gone away. So I guess, you know, that's the sorrows of being a superpower?
Well, that's definitely a true and valid critique. There are a lot of countries in Asia that are saying, oh, this U.S. partners in Asia, the pivot is not what it was promised to be because of continued U.S. interest in the Middle East and Eastern Europe, Central Europe, whatever you want to call it. I think that maybe it was, again, the pivot was supposed to be not just military. So I think inevitably Asia is and is becoming even more the economic center of the world. So whatever happens in the Middle East, Russia, that's going to continue. But, yeah, I mean, I think that the administration perhaps overestimated how quickly it could shift and underestimated some of these other problems.
Well,
I still think the overall, the general idea, just the basic idea, which is that in the long run, Asia is going to be the center of most important things happening in the world is probably accurate, but it doesn't mean it's going to happen as quickly as they thought.
Well, Joshua Kurtlancic, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Joshua Kurtlancic, who is a fellow for Southeast Asia at the Council on Foreign Relations and was a columnist for Time, a special correspondent for The New Republic, a senior correspondent for The American Prospect, and a contributing writer for Mother Jones. His books include Charm Offensive, How China's Soft Power is Transforming the World, and Democracy in Retreat, The Revolt of the Middle Class and the Worldwide Decline of Representative Government. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about a way around the telecom and cable monopolies who are about to eviscerate net neutrality.